Welcome to the You've Caught That Right podcast. It's me, David Nolan,
and Nick Stewart.
You're listening to the You've Caught That Right podcast with me, David Nolan, and my co-host, Craig Stewart. I would just like to apologise first off the bat for the last podcast we made. Craig was introduced as Craig Skinner. I don't know where that came from. That was a bit of a mistake on my part. You'd think I've only known you all my life, so you'd think I'd have known your surname, but I was in the flow. I suppose it wasn't terribly off, was it?
Yeah, I mean, it starts with the same letter. Close enough.
I mean, that's what we do with all things, isn't it?
Exactly.
So firstly, we'd just like to say that we've had some good feedback from the Stoicism podcast, and we're probably looking to do more kind of specials, just kind of focusing on one topic within the kind of bonus episodes. So if any of the listeners have got any suggestions that they would like to hear in bonus episodes, we would be happy to hear that. You can contact us on Twitter at Quote Right Podcast and let us know. Mm-hmm. But for this week, we'll get the show started. So, Craig, you, in the usual format, do you want to take us away?
Let's go. So, this is probably pretty popular quote, because it's Confucius, and he's a popular guy as far as philosophy goes. So, yeah. He's an interesting character. He's got some of his quotes you don't realise they're his because you've heard them all your life until you actually see that's Confucius. And I know that some of them might seem cliche, but they're only that way because they're so popular. And it's not a cliche. It just seems that way. So this one it's well known, but it's not the top one. I think what's the top one again?
Don't eat yellow snow.
Yeah, that's definitely Confucius. What a snow.
A wise man once said, don't eat yellow snow.
he's got so many as well, and you know, it's one of those mental blocks where you're like, I could probably rhyme them off if I knew it was him.
The thing is as well, he's greatly misquoted. He's one of these people that's greatly misquoted. Along with the Buddha's terribly misquoted, which mm-hmm. is, you'll see if you actually, people actually read the quotes, they'll go, oh, the Buddha said, and you'll go, actually, no, it wasn't him that said that, it was somebody else, really. But people, I suppose people just run with what they've heard, they don't bother to do the research, so it's understandable.
It's a fair point, because especially Confucius, between translation and context, it's quite difficult, because you'll just get like a list of top quotes. And the one that has popped into my head finally is never do to others what you would not like them to do to you, and it's been said in different ways, unto others as you would do yourself or whatever. It's a funny one because some people are so self-destructive that you wouldn't want that to be the case. So yeah, that one, I get it. It just maybe doesn't apply to everyone.
If you do free falling in the weekend, probably most folk are not going to go for that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, perspective, but that wasn't my quote. that's the common one, more slightly uncommon one. So this is my quote. I suppose it has, again, open to interpretation, because what someone says and what they actually mean might be two different things. But so it does not matter how slowly you go, so long as you do not stop.
Yeah, that's it. I actually think I posted that quote this week somewhere on social media, because I was laughing because I had been out my first long run, probably through the full winter, probably since the start of December. I mean, we're now at the end of January. and the whole thing for me was that usually I'll go out and I'll try and get a decent time in the run, but I'd been out with the goal of getting the distance, do you know what I mean? And there was times, I think I ran four and a half miles, mm-hmm. Which is for myself, when you're carrying a little bit of holiday weight, it's not easy, you know what I mean? But I think there was times definitely where I stopped and I kind of was walking for maybe 20, 30 seconds and then I'd be back on it for another half a mile or whatever. But it's so true. As long as you don't stop, progress will be made.
You kind of, especially running, you kind of go into maybe a bit of a trance or a meditative type state where you're not really actually thinking about running, you're just doing it. And that's kind of half of what I interpreted from that quote is, you can kind of plod along at your own pace and not know you are, and that's not stopping. You're kind of just doing your thing, and I think it's when you stop. I don't think it means blindly run through life and don't take a moment to think. I don't think it means that. It's more around, keep yourself occupied. Maybe just don't, if you get too idle, especially with things like exercise, it's very easy to kind of be idle in the mind as well and just slow right down to crawling pace, and that's when your mind does start to it's almost like a muscle. It's like it starts wearing away at itself if you don't keep it occupied.
It's almost it's much easier for self-sabotage to set in if you stop, because I suppose you're not, if you're not doing whatever you were supposed to be doing, you're not physically seeing that even if you do persist, you will get to where you want to be. So I suppose the less times you show yourself that, the more you're likely to believe that you can't do it. And basically, that's the way I would interpret it. Aye.
And that's why it is quite an open one. Like, there is no right or wrong kind of thought about a quote, that you just kind of go with how it affects you. If it means something to you or if it helps you along, then it's a good thing. Not to say that all quotes are good or bad. I suppose that there isn't good or bad unless it's outwardly encouraging something specifically evil, but it's more of a kind of say these things to yourself when you maybe feel like you're veering off track slightly.
So, is that your first quote then, Anne?
That is my first quote. I have no further thoughts on the matter.
I think that's a good one to start us off. I think, like we said, it can be interpreted different ways, but it almost is explanatory to most folk that will probably read it. I've said it previously. I know Confucius can be a bit kind of pick the bones out of that kind of thing, like, and I believe stuff of that era and philosophy that's been translated from whatever kind of Chinese or dialect it is, it probably has been then been translated into Old English or whatever the first language, Old Latin, and then translated through Latin and English. So it probably has lost a bit, but aye, it's a good quote.
Yeah, it could have started off as "Live fast, die young," or something like that.
Aye, but aye. So, well, I'll move on to my quote then. So this week on the 27th of January we had Holocaust Memorial Day. Don't know if you were aware of that or not. I'm always slightly, I don't know, slightly touched by Holocaust Memorial Day, and I think it's obviously that's just human nature because of what's well, obviously what's happened and what it signifies. I think the fact that I've been to Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration camp as well, and I've stood inside the camp and I've been in the gas chambers and I've seen the magnitude of the place. It's really hot. It's harrowing, do you know what I mean? It's a weird experience.
Yeah, you can be told about something history or be told that something happened. When you see something physically or a part of it physically, that's when you it almost hits you hope it hits home, and
It's obviously you've got these folk that don't believe it. They've got the Holocaust deniers, which is fucking mental. Like the camp's there, the camp's built, so it's like, what did they do? What at the end of the war did they throw these camps up, half built, just to make it look like fucking they could, so they could write that this happened? You know what I mean? Like, get a grip. You'll seriously get a bit.
I just don't. I mean, obviously, it's about there's a lot of Holocausts, and that one just being a particularly prominent one and recent history one. It's just, yeah, it's just one of those subjects that you don't, you shouldn't stop talking about, because history repeats itself, and if you don't stop talking about it, that history will just repeat itself if people get complacent about that type of thing.
Yeah. So obviously in kind of touch with it, in touch with it being Holocaust Memorial Day, my quote is from Anne Frank. So Anne Frank, she was born in 1929 in Germany, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And her and her family had to then flee Germany. Obviously, once the Nazi kind of uprising started, when the Jews started being persecuted within Germany, they had to obviously leave and get out. So her dad, I believe her dad knew people, or they had family in Amsterdam. So they then fled to Amsterdam, and in 1942 they went into hiding in an annex in the loft space, basically, of a kind of small Amsterdam building.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've not actually been to Anne Frank House, but obviously I've seen documentaries and stuff about it, and the size of the annex that they lived in for so long was absolutely
ridiculously small space for
tiny,
much of time.
But when your life's in danger, then you don't really care of the space as long as you're not being discovered. So they went into hiding, and then there was another family. I don't have the family's name off the top of my head. They then joined them there, I think, maybe 6 days later. And they were then finally followed by, there was a dentist, a Jewish dentist that followed them in. The names have kind of slipped my mind. But
mm-hmm.
So this lot of people lived in this small annex for so long. And it was in there, obviously, that Anne Frank wrote her famous diary.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've read the diary, but it's I read the diary at school. I think a lot of people get taught it at school, but it's one of these things that I think if you read it at school, you only half understand it, whereas if you read it from an adult's perspective later on, it affects you more, like it hits home a lot harder. So I reread it, I think it was a year after I went to Auschwitz, which was only about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I just actually couldn't believe, like, I had to keep checking facts on it. Like, I couldn't believe the fact that she was in her very early teens, do you know what I mean? And stuff like that. Like, because her writing, obviously it's been translated, was like that of, there's adults probably struggle to write of such a high quality, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think probably that life experience, and it's a bit sad that her life experience was a hard life instead of like a carefree teenager, and that's maybe why she's kind of matured quickly in mind.
Yeah, so Anne and Frank, obviously they went into hiding, and then they were captured on 3rd of September in 1944, and the full family, they were deported to Auschwitz concentration camp, where I believe that the mother and the daughters were separated from Otto Frank, which is obviously Anne's father.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually Anne ended up in Belsen concentration camp, where she died at some point in February 1945.
Mm-hmm.
That alone is kind of sad, because obviously it wasn't very long before the war ended and the camps were all liberated, do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it's food for thought as well, though, that obviously Otto Frank, her father, was only one in the family that survived, but he then went on to, he was given this diary, somebody had kept it, and he was given it, and he read it, and read it, and he didn't know whether to publish it or not, do you know what I mean, or let the public see it. But then, at the same time, he kind of thought, well, maybe there is a message here, so he released it to the public, and well, look, it's known world over now, do you know what I mean? It's remarkable. There's such remarkable strength behind a lot of these people that have survived these camps, there's a lot of books out now from different points of view, and a lot of them are really, really good to read. But anyway, so my quote for Anne Frank is, "It's difficult in times like these. Ideals, dreams, and cherished hopes rise within us, only to be crushed by grim reality. It's a wonder that I haven't dropped all my ideals because they seem so absurd and impossible to carry out. Yet I keep them because, in spite of everything, I still believe that people are really good at heart." So that's for me to, for somebody to write that when they're being persecuted so savagely, do you know what I mean? Their people are being hunted down, basically like vermin, do you know what I mean?
It's harsh. It's even more harsh when you to have perspective in times like that where you think that where someone is thinking, you know what, it can't be all bad, even though this is terrible. I still have faith in humanity, which is it's insane because I would have zero faith by that point.
The funny thing is, it's the fact that she's obviously looking at the world with that perspective, that she's still seeing the good in things and she's still able to see the good, even though she's trapped in an attic for like 2 years, 3 years, do you know what I mean? And yet, folk that are in lockdown, they now can't stay in the house, do you know what I mean? When they've got TVs, they've got every cooking facility under the sun, they've got central heating, they've got, do you know what I mean? They've got many forms of entertainment, and it's kind of recently I've been thinking this is a kind of age of despair, the 20s and 2020, and because there's nothing to be discovered now, like everything. Well, there is obviously scientific discovery, but everybody's got everything that they could ever wish for, more or less. And I know there's obviously homeless folk and there's folk that don't have houses and they don't folk that are poorer than other folk, but nobody takes that amazement and discovery anymore. It's as if when things are discovered now, they come up and people just go, "All right, well, that's cool, I'll have that." But they don't actually look at it as, "Wait a minute,
That's amazing.
we didn't have virtual reality recent like years before," or everything that's discovered just slots into society and is accepted. Do you know what I mean? It's crazy.
It's
Like.
almost like clutter. Like there's just too much clutter now. And no one can slow down to go, wait a minute, yeah. Look at this stuff that's happened. Look at these things that have been discovered and invented. But yeah, there's maybe just so much going on, and it's probably half the problem with how people are nowadays and general unhappiness is that there's just too much going on. There's too much stimuli, and people don't slow down and go, wow, I'm amazed about something in nature. I'm amazed that they invented the mobile phone. And I know that we don't all sit around going, wow, everything's amazing. I've got a house. Imagine a house. Who could do such a thing? But it does pay, I think, to take a moment to go, maybe a wee bit more grateful for the things I do have rather than what I don't.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's obviously everybody's got their problems, but it's when you look at that in perspective of what was going on in that person's life at that time, and obviously her life obviously took an even worse downturn once she was arrested and admitted into the camps. It would have been a terrible time for her, you know what I mean? But people are needing more gratitude in towards what they've got, I would say, do you know what I mean? And everybody's guilty of it, I think, these days, not looking and going, "Oh, wait a minute, I'm grateful for." See, even the wee things like the smell of a cup of coffee in the morning and that kind of stuff. Like, all these things are not a given. Do you know what I mean? There could be any kind of disaster that wipes out plantations, even things like coffee or certain types of food, and you never see them again. But yet, you stuff them down your throat and you think, "Ah, that's fine. Don't think about it." You know what I mean?
Yes,
But
it's like someone that's dying of thirst, or well, not necessarily dying, but they're so thirsty that they're gasping and they're on their last legs because they're dehydrated. And someone tasting simple plain water that can taste like the best thing I've ever had because they didn't have anything before it, and you're just so desperate for something. Or the same for food. If you all you've eaten bread, all you have done is sit in a prison and eat bread. like maybe I'm talking about maybe a very, very old prison here, but the point is that when it's not part of your daily or regular, thing, you probably imagine you stop drinking something, basically just a drink that you love, for example, and then you try that again a year later. What would it taste like?
Right, I think what you're basically what you're saying is we get lost in the kind of blandness, the monotonous of something because we're exposed to it for so long. But take it away and bring it back, and it's like nothing you've ever had. Do you know what I mean? But so that was the thing. That was obviously my quote for that.
I was going to say, so just on the subject, the Holocaust, and I really didn't know the kind of scale of some of the other Holocausts to mention, so I thought I'd just mention a couple more, just while you're on the subject, and actually just checking this just now to see what the actual Holocaust Day means overall, and to just name a couple more. There was a Cambodian Holocaust in the 70s, which is, extremely recent history, by Pol Pot, and that was basically extremists essentially deciding that, we are going to change this country, and that was millions. That they just ruined the country so much. A lot of that was starvation and exhaustion, and between that and execution. So, it just to point out, like, it's not an isolated thing. Holocaust, it should be. It's insane that it's happened so often. Each individual country isn't sitting aware going, well, we're expecting a Holocaust, or the people that caused them might not necessarily be aware at first. Obviously, Hitler was very well aware, considering the nature of it. But you've got other places like Rwanda, and that was in the 90s, which is, again, it's just crazy. Like, someone's justification of another, that was basically just between different groups of people. That was like almost a million people in just about 100 days. It's unthinkable. That's a very small portion a year. Bosnia in the 90s, that was a Holocaust. Well, basically a mass slaughter of Muslims. And then Darfur in 2000, that was the early 2000s. So yeah, I just thought on the subject, I thought I'd kind of see a bit more about kind of other things that have happened, and it's shocking. That's definitely not all of them, as far as genocide goes. So yeah, it's quite scary.
No, it's definitely, but the good thing is that this girl's legacy obviously lives on, and that's the important thing. And part of the I'll say is my final point on this quote is that I seen a guy that was on social media just interviewing people. It's a guy, it's a comedy, I can't remember who he is. He's a guy basically, but he just interviews people. He kind of one of these ones, he'll ask them questions just to take the piss out of them because they'll give stupid answers. Do you know what I mean? Or they'll people that are ignorant. And I sincerely hope I've seen him show a photo of Anne Frank to a few folk and didn't have a clue who it was. And I sincerely hope that's just people that are genuinely stupid and or even maybe a bit ignorant. But if there's one thing in humanity we can't forget what happened here, and that's basically the way I feel about it.
Yeah, and it's good that Germany are taking that stance too, so don't hide it, put it out there and show that this just can't happen again. This just shouldn't happen again. If you bury it away, pretend it didn't happen. You can't do that with things on that scale or anything that's life changing for so many people. You can't.
Yeah, so that's that quote then. So do you want to go on with your news slash media quote or whatever it is you've got for us up second?
My quote from this week is quite a good one, very recently. In the news, we had an Australian woman posting a video, and the news caught on to it. Well, the whole media. So this is a woman in her daughter's bedroom in Australia, and the quote starts off as, "Are you moving out now? Should I burn the house down?"
Right.
So what happened there was the mother came into the child's bedroom and spotted that there was a little group of spiders in the corner above the window that seemed to have
Right.
hatched. And then in the video, she turns around and there's another even larger group of spiders. They're pretty small. Well, they're like our big spiders in Britain.
Nice. Nice, they're not that big in comparison to Australian spiders, are not that big.
Yeah, there were baby huntsman spiders that hatched recently, and huntsman spiders get pretty big. They're not dangerous spiders of all the things in Australia that can kill you. So I think that's why they weren't too freaked out. I don't know how they must just be familiar with different species, but I certainly wouldn't have been that close to them. I'm not certainly not an arachnophobe, but when you see a big group of insects, you're probably a wee bit concerned, especially even animals. If I seen like a massive group of rats, I would be like, that's not normal. But yeah, spiders in particular in your house, as natural as they are, yeah. Yeah, like so the woman that's quite a common one, like we should burn the house down, get a flamethrower, do this, do that, but I'm kind of, yeah, one or two spiders I'm all right with. I do, it kind of surprises you when you see a large spider, because in your house you just go about your business and they're everywhere, you just don't see them.
You walk into your house and there's a large spider just sitting on the couch, just
Well, yeah, drinking your wine, like, hey, wait a minute. You get a bit upset about that kind of thing. It's a bit intrusive, to say the least. Like, get out of my fridge. Yeah, like, I suppose that might actually be nicer, to be honest. Yeah, I think when people see that many spiders, to not panic, even in Australia, people are kind of like, oh, that's a lot of spiders. But what they done was they opened the window and they blew into the house,
All
some
right.
of them. So they were running about catching them. They weren't trying to kill them. In this case, they decided that, it was the spider's right to exist. So they managed to catch them all and get them out of the house. So yeah, they were freed, not harmed. Personally, I don't feel great about killing spiders unless you just can't be bothered. You're in your bed and you spot one in the ceiling and you think, I don't really want that on me, so I'll get rid
That's
of
the
it.
Aye, I'm not. I don't really kill insects either. There's not really anything here in Scotland that makes that much is that much a threat to you that you need to like kill it. Do you know what I mean? I know that it's like I'm kind of against it anyway. But it's funny. It's just I seen a thing the day. It was a photo like photos, and it was like spiders. It was like spiders. Slugs, snails, worms, beetles, and in Scotland they're all just in a bracket and it's beasties.
Everything's a
Just beasties.
beastie. You don't call it
Aye.
by its own name. And I think beastie is better than bug.
But you don't really get any like tough, like hard insects here that are like vicious or like vicious insects. Like hear you, where you been?
Yeah, like premeditated biting of people.
Like Ned Spider, where you
I
been?
feel that way about seagulls and stuff, though. I genuinely think that seagulls are malicious. They're
My.
premeditated. I know that they're just trying to survive. But, I mean, come on. Like, I'm eating my roll. I don't need you to take it out of my mouth.
And they're definitely laughing as well, aren't they?
That's not normal behaviour. They're definitely, like, the way that they circle and laugh or just sit on a fence and laugh at you.
I can't abide by birds either. I just don't get how they just get to fly about and shit everywhere. Do you know what I
It's
mean?
not fair. Like, I mean, come on, bit of consideration.
No, but aye. So I just I don't know. There's a lot of people who are scared that I don't know why spiders cause so, like such fear in people. I think it's the fact that they're fast as well
Yeah.
and unpredictable, like in the direction that they take when you go to try and put a glass over it, put it outside, it runs at you. You kind of freak out about it, even if you don't particularly mind them. But
It makes you, it
aye.
really makes you wonder though, like a lot of fears are built in so that like a survival instinct, like don't go near that huge bear, it's got pretty big teeth. Or like the howling of a wolf kind of makes you a bit on edge if you've ever heard like or fox cries or anything like an animal kind of making a sound, it kind of makes you sit up and you wonder what it is, even if it's not a threat anymore. So there's a bit in your brain, your kind of your wee hind brain that kind of goes, oh wait a minute, that's something that I should be worried about. So what makes me worry is now spiders nowadays are probably pretty bad, and obviously in some countries bad enough to be scared of, but what the heck were they like to make us so scared of them nowadays in the past that kind of settled into our brains that way? So there might have been undiscovered huge spiders that terrorized people in the past that we don't know about, so maybe just we'll spare a thought for our ancestors.
So I've been reading a book by James Clear called Atomic Habits. I don't know if you've ever seen it or heard of it. Basically, it's one of these books that's been kind of more and more talked about over the last couple of years since it came out, more and more famous. And he's been on a lot of podcasts talking and stuff, and he's quite what he's got to say basically about the subject. These books quite interesting. So basically, it's the book's basically just talking about forming good habits for yourself and how basically you can improve your life just like bit by bit. And it is quite an interesting book. I'm kind of usual late to the party, so I'm just reading it. Obviously, it's been out a couple of years, but it's a very very highly kind of sought after book. And in the book, he discusses basically different formats, like in relation to forming habits, like how if you want to kind of stick a habit, it's better to change the environment that you live in or you're surrounded by will help improve how you do the habit kind of thing. And I think he uses an example of how he used to buy apples all the time and he would keep them in a corner of the kitchen and never touch them, and they've got a date, and then just simply taking the apples and buying a decent sized fruit bowl and placing them more in the middle of the work surface, they kind of stand out. And then, do you know what I mean? He's eating more and more of them. So it's kind of things like that. And then he's talking about just basically different habit triggers and stuff, how we're constantly triggered, even for bad habits. It starts elsewhere from where you think, do you know what I mean? Like you're triggered by something else that will then lead you to that bad habit of going and eating junk food or whatever. It gives a really good kind of different methods of how to start these habits for yourself, how to improve yourself. And he's got a method called habit stacking, which is basically if you already have got a habit in place of something that you do. For instance, if you in the morning you make yourself a cup of coffee, you can stack another habit on top of that. So you'll basically say to yourself, in the morning I'll have my when I make my coffee, I will have my vitamins. And then straight after, so then one habit kind of leads into another. So you then would leave your vitamins basically in front next to your kettle or on the board. Do you know what I mean? And then you can do that. But
Makes
he
sense.
talks as well. He talks as well about it's small improvements basically that people don't discredit small improvements. So the quote I've got from the actual book itself is, "Making a choice that is 1% better or worse seems insignificant in the moment. Over the span of moments that make up a lifetime, these choices determine the difference between who you are and who you could be." He's basically saying it's 1% improvements are vital, basically, because 1% over time in the right direction will be a massive improvement. Where, as you can imagine, if 1% in the other direction, if you don't do the thing, then you're going to be so much worse off. Do you know what I mean? So It makes so much sense because it's accumulations of what we do now, day to day, moment to moment. It's who we are. Like, if we eat 500 calories less every day for the next 30, 40 days, we could be, say, 2, 3, 4, 5 pounds lighter in 40 days' time. Do you know what I mean? But if we eat another 500 calories on what, on top of what we're eating, we could be 2, 3, 4 pounds later. Do you know what I mean? And that's just a simple one small change here makes a difference to the future. Do you know what I mean?
Similarly, if you like, I think the point of that seems to be if you try to go too far, like if you try to expect a large improvement over a short time, it's probably going to be, it's not going to last as long. Well, depends on how good you are at sticking to things, but it's more unlikely to work if you take a crash diet or something, for example. You're probably just not going to tune into it. You'll see it as something negative, but if you make a smaller change that doesn't seem like a hassle, and just make it part of your routine, yeah, it makes sense that the gain from that will be longer term. And like you say about the 1%, if you keep accumulating 1%, it'll add up to a lot of benefit for you if it's a beneficial habit. So yeah, it's an interesting take on it. It seems obvious, but you just don't think that way.
The thing is, the kind of president behind the principles behind the book are not what you would think on first glance. The thing is, long-term goals are actually more likely to lead to dissatisfaction than small term improvements. And I think that's the point it's putting across. But the book itself is actually stating that goals are actually no use in the long term, because what you need to do is, it's not, see if you change to meet a goal. So if you say I want to run a marathon, you train hard, work hard, you do the marathon, and the minute the goal's achieved, you, most people probably, and I've done it myself, your running falls out by the wayside, you stop running, you become deflated, you maybe become more unfit again and stuff. So basically what he's saying is, the system should be not to run a marathon, but to be a marathon runner. Tell yourself, what would a marathon runner do? So you're constantly, you're more training to be that level of runner over time than to just run the one marathon and stop. Do you know what I mean? So it makes so much more sense. It's like you said, and he's basically talking about how to be that goal and be part of that system, you have to morph yourself in and become, and start to become part of the mindset that you need to achieve what you want to achieve. Do you know what I mean? Rather than just trying to achieve a goal. So it's a very interesting book, and I'd highly recommend it. Atomic Habits by James Clear. It's available just about everywhere that you can buy a book. So I would recommend that.
Yeah, sounds good. I mean, any sort of life improvement that is genuine, because it's not like one of these books that's become, the best social person in the world. Like, if that's not your personality, it's probably unlikely. I know that if you said, you know what, I want to be more sociable and I want to speak to more people that I don't really know, then if you take the smaller habit change approach, you might get to that point and then it'll become more natural and you might actually find that's you as a person. You've just got certain things holding you back. So I don't necessarily, like, I probably wouldn't read a book like How to Win Friends and Influence People, because it sounds like that's a personality change or a, I don't know, like something like a quick fix or something. It just.
Well, I know what you're saying. I've never read that book in per se. Per se, don't call me per se. But my name's Craig. But Dale Carnegie, that wrote that book, I believe, I've read one or two of his other books, and he is actually, for his time, he was a highly sought after and kind of highly respected writer. But I don't know if it is. It's like you say, the title of that book, and there's loads of people rave about it. It just is kind of, for me, it's kind of off-putting. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it sounds like it's trying too hard slightly.
Yeah. No, it's definitely, I would recommend the book. by James Clear to most people that like to read that kind of thing. And maybe probably actually even to folk that don't like to read that kind of thing, because it isn't a big book. It's only like Ganga's like 260 pages, but it flows quite well. It's quite easy reading. And I think you could, if you take anything out of it at all, then you've benefited, you know what I
Yeah,
mean?
most of these things, most people, you want to improve something or get better at something or have a wider kind of look at, well, what I'm unhappy about something, what can I do to change that? I can do this and that. So yeah, it's not like the whole book isn't just about doing that one thing, but clearly it'll give you kind of hints and tips to be able to put these things into place in your life. So yeah, sounds pretty interesting.
For the last quotes, as you were aware, it was Burns Night this week as well, the 25th, so we're 5 days ago. And I seen this quote. I thought it was a bit, it was slightly stupid that they had attached a haggis to a weather balloon, which had then orbited into space. Well, obviously, once it had been into space, it had then fallen back down to Earth. So the quote from one of the representatives of the company was that after reaching over 107,000 feet with views of at least 250 miles, the haggis then fell from Earth at nearly 200 miles per hour before the parachute took over, meaning it's probably the fastest haggis in the world too. So,
What I
aye.
find funny about that is the comment about views. So the haggis could see
Aye.
those views.
That's the thing as well. I love the Scottish mentality, and for people that listen outside Scotland and like America and places, they aren't aware of this. Haggis is not an animal, and
What?
I love this. What's that a shock? Is that I've ruined Santa for you, and I've ruined the
Hello.
haggis so
Wait a
well.
minute. Right, and I have a word with my mum and dad. I'm 35 and I'm pretty disappointed to hear that.
You were never able to catch a haggis, but it's just I love the great fact that the Scottish mentality and the humour is the fact that we've went on in our droves and commented on social media posts for years and years and years and about haggis hunting, and there's obviously going to be folk from different parts of the world reading that and going, oh, it's so good that you can catch these haggis and stuff, because I've seen some comments about folk talking about catching haggises on a slow cooker page that I'm on and stuff, and I was just I find it hilarious that the people have kept keeping the joke going for so
Yeah, and
long.
a
So
bit
I
of Darwinism is that they've got different size legs on each side so they can walk around hills. So that's quite interesting. Evolution, fake evolution.
I wasn't aware of that
Yeah,
either, but I.
they've got the legs are shorter on one side. The side that's nearest the top of the hill, so that they can kind of scuttle about the side of the hill. The only problem is they can only really go in one direction, but it's quite interesting. Anyway, that's my dream shattered. I did enjoy a bit of haggis during the week, but it was unfortunately a mock haggis, a vegetarian haggis, as nice as it was.
I was laughing as well because I seen online one of the newspapers, I can't remember what exact newspaper had posted on Twitter. If this is the most, if this is not the most woke Burns Night ever, then I don't know what is. I believe that's what the quote was. And then it was a link to somebody had posted that they were having a vegetarian and alcohol-free whiskey Burns Night, right? So I think it was Mark, the comedian Mark Watson. And basically, he went on and slated this guy for retweeted and slated this guy for writing people that don't know the meaning of woke. Right? So it was just funny, aye. But aye.
Well, if it was a gluten-free vegetarian or vegan haggis and a vegan alcohol-free whiskey, I don't know how you can get vegan whiskey.
I don't know why you bother. Like, non-alcoholic beer tastes exactly like beer, obviously, and it is quite refreshing. If it's like the odd cold bottle and you're driving or whatever, right, fair enough. I don't see the extent of why you want to drink alcoholic free spirits, which seem to be a popular thing now. Whiskey is an acquired taste to most folk that drink it. I mean, I like a whiskey now and then, and different kind of styles of whiskey, but I don't see what the reward is or the point is from drinking non-alcoholic whiskey. Do you
I'm
know what I mean?
confused because you're what essentially we're talking about here is burnt wood water,
Ah, exactly.
and who
Aye.
wants to drink that? It's the alcohol in it that brings out the flavors that are inside it, so it kind of is about the alcohol base.
I like drinking a sticking a straw in a peat bog puddle.
Oh, maybe good for you in some way, detox. I get why someone would be reactionary to something being woke because there's a lot of that about just now, but yeah, maybe slightly misunderstood as that comedian said, but it does annoy me, that type of thing, where someone likes to kind of virtue signal about how, how they're cutting out meat, and they probably always did, because I would say that I'm the type of person that doesn't have meat with every meal, and I never have, but I wouldn't start advertising it as if, oh wait, this is popular now, so I'll start telling people that I've been doing this, like, look at me. So yeah, that kind of thing does annoy me. I don't.
I don't know. The thing is, I've never understood it. Like, as you very well know, I was vegetarian for probably, I think I worked it was almost about 10 years I was vegetarian. Into my mid, feel like my kind of late mid-teens to my mid-twenties. I'm no longer vegetarian. However, I had my reasons for being vegetarian, never ever really forced it on people. However, I would refuse anything that I didn't want to eat, do you know what I mean? Given by folk, and even when I changed back. But I don't understand this wayside of forcing your opinions on people. If you want to be vegan, be vegan. If you don't, do you know what I mean? But both sides of the argument just need to kind of live and let's say, I don't even know the
Living
quote. Live and let
let
live.
die. Oh wait, that's James Bond.
Love and La Vida Loca.
There's a lot of good either songs or kind of phrases that start with live. Should have listed some shit if I knew this was going to happen. But yeah, like I think that works with everything. Don't force your shit on people.
So I do that my quote. Hi, Haggis.
I like it. But yeah, big haggis fan myself. So yeah, my final quote. Now this is someone that I really appreciate is some of his takes on life, even though he's a fictional character. And this is Ron Swanson from Parks and Rec. He's a funny guy, well written. At first, he comes across as a bit of a brash American that just wants to eat meat all the time and build things out of wood. But they've written him quite well. He's a bit more of a complex character, and the satire side of Parks and Recreation lends itself to some of these types of quotes. So from Ron Swanson, one of his, and I think this might be from, basically Ron Swanson had a group of scouts, or the American equivalent. I think it's still called scouts. He wanted to show these boys how to live life, and he made himself a Ron Swanson pyramid of greatness. So he's got various quotes on there. It's things like about skimmed milk being, it's lying about being milk and things like that. And this one's quite funny because it's clearly satire. So this one is capitalism, God's way of determining who's smart and who is poor. So that is it kind of distills capitalism down to one thing. And people that are, I mean, we live in a capitalist society, and that's, it is what it is. And it's got its merits, it's got its downfalls, but there's probably people that genuinely believe that, that you know, you're either rich or you're stupid. And it kind of goes that way. Like, you kind of, some people see money and being rich as success. Everyone's got their own definition of success, but it tends to be a world that rides itself on, or prides itself on, having loads of money and hoarding it. Or, you know, people look to people like Bill Gates, who's probably an actual good example of someone with money, to be fair, to the people like Jeff Bezos, where you've got like stinking rich amounts of money hoarding it, and the wealth in these countries, capitalist countries, is just hoarded by a select few people. And that's not to say that these people didn't earn it. Like, if you work hard, you know, you reap the benefits. But what does it say about a society that kind of prides, it sees success as having money or making enough money to show off to other people how much you've got or how much you can buy? It kind of, it gets a wee bit, you kind of see the downsides of it more and more. I'm not saying I have a solution or that the alternative is a good thing either, because there is no, you can't brand any way of any kind of societal structure as a definite, that is the way to go, because there's ups and downs at every single way of doing these things. But capitalism, yeah, when it's at its extreme, is kind of damaging, and some people do genuinely see, you know, the smart people have got the money, the poor people don't. And people like me probably would be considered one of the poor people. Like, even though my life's perfectly fine, I earn enough to enjoy myself. So yeah, like, success to me, success isn't money, essentially.
No, success is definitely not money, and it's proven more and more in recent studies on happiness that I think $75,000 and roughly about £50,000 a year salary is the kind of happiness bracket for most folk. Anything over that people's happiness doesn't improve any. I mean, the thing is, happiness is definitely not linked to money. I think it was Arthur Schopenhauer famously said, "Wealth is like seawater. The more you drink, the more you want, and the same can be said for fame." I don't. That's not quote unquote exactly, but that is basically what he said, and it's so true. Do you know what I mean? Like, you don't meet many millionaires that don't want another million, or you don't meet. Do you know what I mean? The billion, the people at the top bracket of millionaires probably say, "Oh, if I could be a billionaire," or do you know what I mean? It really, really counts for nothing. What probably counts more is if you have that wealth, what you do with the wealth. Do you know what I mean? How you distribute the wealth and how you help
Yeah,
people.
and that's why Bill Gates is a good example, probably. But however people feel about him and the amount of money that he's made through Microsoft, he certainly shares a good proportion of that.
Is, money's definitely not a happiness factor, to be honest with you. It allows you to live comfortably to a certain degree, and then after that, it's pretty pointless, to be honest with you. There's another quote that I remember roughly, and it's, "If you really don't like somebody, buy them a lottery ticket." That is because the science and research into, apparently, lottery winners are some of the most depressed people in the world. There was a lottery winner in Texas, I believe. Everything kind of went, he won the lottery, and everything kind of went tits up for him after he won the lottery. And it's the case for a lot of folk. And eventually he killed himself because he was just so unhappy, but yet he'd won the lottery. Now, most folk obviously looking at him at the first instance would have went, "Oh, imagine, I can only imagine what it'd be like to win the lottery." So if you really don't like somebody, buy them a lottery ticket, which is something I always remember, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. I mean, what do you do when you've reached the end of the chain, or the what you think of as the dream? If you've got money to do whatever you want and you don't have to wait for anything, what do you do? What have you got to reach for? And what is it that you want so bad that you would think would extend your happiness? Like you say about the £50,000 thing, like, if you can live comfortably, because you don't want to worry about having too little money, that's just as bad. Because what do you do when you can't afford to feed your kids? What do you do when you can't feed yourself, or get the basics like heating? And so you've got a balance there to strike. And plus, if you're making so much money, you're probably working way more than the average person. And that certainly doesn't extend my happiness.
That's the thing. I think in terms of, especially when you see it more in America, we get all right kind of holidays here with most, like most jobs are entitled holiday entitlement. In America, a lot of jobs until you're so many years and you're not, and you're basically not entitled to any holidays as far as I'm aware. Do you know what I mean? You're working more, and in America, more money equates working more, which means less time doing what you love or seeing your family or that kind of thing. And happiness, the funny thing about happiness is, and the way I look at happiness is, we're sold a huge fucking lie basically when it comes to happiness from childbirth, and what we're sold as happiness isn't what equates happiness really. Do you know what I mean?
Success,
It's
well, not just success, but what seems
well we're
success.
no well that as well, but we're taught that if we can be X, Y, Z type of person or in such a career, or if we have or when we have such and such a thing, we will be happy. And we're painted this picture really of a life that will eventually reach a point where if you say, oh, but it's just over the horizon, and then when I get that, I'll be, and then it'll be this happily ever after, where which will just be eternal happiness, which happiness is actually a fleeting thing, which is just like any other emotion that is, we can attain it. It can be attained, but not through the modes that we're taught in the West, where it is, if it's a kind of materialistic approach of owning, buying, having this size of house, that size of house, out with your means to make the neighbours jealous or competing with the family, or it's not, that isn't happiness, and that's the lie that we're sold through our life.
It's
It's
a
just
losing battle.
I don't think it's a losing battle as such, but I think once we somebody actually breaks that news to us and goes, tells us, actually, you're not going to be happy if that's the way you try to pursue it.
Well,
You can either go two ways. You can it'll kind of be a kind of shattered moment to you when you realise, well, wait a minute, I've bought this, I've bought that, and I'm not happy. Do you know what I mean? Or it'll be profound, and you realise that happiness is actually in what you can do for others. It's in the small things. It's in being part of nature, having gratitude. Do you know what I mean? Contributing to society. Happiness is very, your memories of happiness are very rarely when you were given or bought a material thing. Do you know what I mean? It's usually something stupid like going for, I don't know, like having an ice cream or having a nice meal with your loved ones, or do you know what I mean? Being out for dinner and you have a laugh and spending time with people rather than actually being, you've like, how many people will say, I'm going to go and study, waste 8 years of my life trying to be a doctor, and then when I'm a doctor, I'll be happy. And then they get in the doctor wrong, or they get in whatever career they're in, and do you know what? They're not any happier. Do you know what I
It's
mean?
not based on a single achievement. It's based on a lifestyle, or what's easiest to do. It's a lot of things are free, that can bring you a bit of happiness. And that, like when I was saying about like a losing battle, it's a losing battle to chase other people's dreams. To look at your neighbors and go, they've got something better than me. I want that. That's someone else's achievement or dream. Like, why are you trying to force that upon yourself or someone
Well,
else?
the thing is as well, it's nobody's really to blame for the unhappiness that's created a lot of the time, because, like I say, we're sold this lie from we're very young children. Do you know what I mean? If the fairy tales that we were told and read when we were young had actually ended badly, it would have been a stark warning for folk that, the princess and whatever doesn't live happily ever after, or Hansel and Gretel, the children actually do get eaten. Do you know what I mean? Like, if that's the way their life was looked, then, and as much as it would be horrible to read that to a 2 or 3 year old, do you know what I mean? It paints that, takes away that picture that if there is happily ever after. Do you know what I mean? There is happiness, but it's not where you think. And then the other thing is, a lot of people grow up, and they're on this track from like probably just before their teens to impress their parents or whatever. Or and there's a saying that's basically along the lines of a child's biggest burden is the unlived lives of their parents, I believe it is, which is it's so true. Do you know what I mean? Like, you see all these stupid shows like Dance Moms and all that, and
Oh.
where the kids, the moms have obviously been dancers, and they're all fighting. The moms are fighting each other because their daughter's getting slated, and the daughter even really looks like she wants to be dancing, but she's getting forced. Do you know what I mean? And or these things like Louis Theroux done, when it's like the beauty pageants and the kids are knee high and they're getting full faces of makeup forced on them, and do you know what I mean? And they don't know why they're there, they don't know why they're competing, do you know what I mean? But they then get conditioned into that, and then eventually
They don't know what why they're doing it. They just
it's what they know, do you know what I mean? They're doing a Saturday or what they do once a month, or and that's that contributes, I believe, to that later unhappiness, do you know what I mean? So,
What does it do to your self-esteem at that age to be put in that environment that you're being judged based on how you look? That's going one direction. And a point on like people having money and stuff, what seems to be the rule rather than the exception is, rich kids, people with parents that are rich, how often do they turn out well adjusted and not drug addicts? Or I know that that's maybe a generalization because there are people out there that will see beyond it, but when there's been no hardship or everything's been handed to you or you've just never had to struggle for anything. You've never learned the value of anything. And I mean, like our earlier conversation, you just, if you put a price on it, you just kind of, you demean the meaning of certain things. So what do you aim for at that point? And then your mind wanders to things like drugs and stuff because people don't know what else to do. Or do something for attention, like so. All these kind of tragic stars are tragic because these are human beings. You might laugh at them and point at them and go, "Ah, well, they've got money, they shouldn't be unhappy." People like maybe Britney Spears are a good example. That was more to do with like the media and stuff and the way that they made her feel. But like, it doesn't always equate. So, perceived success and being famous and having money doesn't always lead to happiness unless the people that you find the happiest are the people that don't really want anything to do with like limelight. They're not trying to be in the public because it makes you a target. You put a big target in your back when if you've got money or you're successful, and yeah, it doesn't always equate to good things.
There's just a lot to be said for happiness and kind of money and stuff wrongly. It's wrongly viewed, basically. The last thing I'll say on that is obviously probably one of the happiest people you'll see in the world is the Dalai Lama, who has, in terms of possessions and want, has very little.
Beyond shelter, food, and yeah, it highlights that point. And that's his lifestyle. It wouldn't suit us all, but it's clearly for him. And yeah, that level of conviction has given him that sense of well-being and having that perspective on life in the world.
That's us for this week, and it's been an interesting one. It's kind of varied, very varied discussion this week.
Wandered off a bit, and
Aye,
certainly.
that's probably best, but that's never a bad thing. But aye, so that's us for this week. And if you would like to contact us, you can contact us through Twitter at Quoteright Podcast, on Instagram at Quoteright Podcast, and if we could ask you a wee favour, could you go on to Podchaser and rate and review the episodes if you've listened to them on there? And we would be eternally grateful. But until the next episode, that's us for now. You've been listening to You've Got That Right Podcast with me and Craig Stewart.
And always remember, one more favour, don't be a dick.